Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
Because I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special New England show. It's a winter going on in 2016. We're up here at Merrimack, Massachusetts, Tamarack Farm with Mark Zappizzotti, our good buddy from New York City, and his friend Patrick Soucy, the chef at Applecrest Orchard up in Hampton Falls, New Hampshire. So this is kind of fun for me. It's a homecoming, being back in my hometown, Haverhill, Massachusetts, for winter going into 2016. Heritage Beer Network is sponsored by Union Beer Distributors, suppliers of great world-class ales and ciders. And looking forward to having a great year, 2016. Cheers.
Cheers.
Guys, thanks for coming on the show with me, Salud. Patrick and Mark. So let's just talk about the scene up here. Mark, you know, you were in New York City. You were an award-winning home brewer. You were doing a lot of things, and you moved up to Merrimack, Massachusetts.
Yep, I traded my 49 by 100 square foot lot for 43 acres, and I didn't look back.
Well, it's kind of fun. Earlier you gave me a tour, and I wasn't sure what to expect, but I called the other day and I said, are you in Massachusetts? And you were. It's the first time I've been to your farm. You've been there for what, 3 years?
Yeah, going on 4 years, and about three and a half at this point. And, you know, farming is one thing I learned being here so far is that farming is a long game. If you come in here with your sort of New York impatience that you want to get something done in a week or 2 weeks or a month, you're going to be sadly mistaken because everything on a farm is long.
So what are you raising here? You know, you're on a historical farm.
I am. This farm has been a farm for a couple hundred years running. The house was built in 1759. The first 100 years, there's no record, but from that point on, it's said to have been an apple orchard. We don't have much apples left, but I'm raising Horn Dorset lambs, growing hops, and I'm having a thriving little cordwood business as well.
Great, man. And this is your buddy, Patrick Soucy. Nice to meet you, man.
Nice to meet you as well.
So you're a chef here in the area.
I am. Chef in coastal New England up in New Hampshire.
So tell us about Applecrest. So Applecrest, it's one of the oldest apple orchards in New Hampshire, right?
Yep. So Applecrest Farm is about 104 years old. It's the oldest and largest apple orchard in New Hampshire. It's an extremely beautiful, sacred place. It's located 6 miles from the Atlantic Ocean, so you get that ocean breeze. You can actually smell the fresh salt water, and you can see the fog out in the orchard when you're sitting at the restaurant. It's just absolutely breathtaking.
Tell you one thing I like, we're usually in the Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and today we're at Mark's farmhouse here.
Merrimack,
we're close to New Hampshire, where Patrick's place is, and we're not too far from Boston, but you said you can get to Maine in about 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah, you can be in southern Maine, where a lot of stuff has been going on as well, in 20 minutes from here. You can be in Portsmouth in 20 minutes. You can be in the White Mountains in under an hour.
could be in Boston.
You can be in Boston in 45 minutes. You could be hiking in 20 minutes one direction, or you can be on the beach in 20 minutes in another. So this is sort of right on Vacation Land Highway.
So this is great. This is, we're going to talk about in this kind of micro region, which has so much history, where you guys are doing some new things. Just in the recent issue of a Beer Advocate, it's funny because we had some of the Hudson Valley brewers up, and we coined the new primitives because they were working with some of their microflora and local ingredients. And I kind of feel like you guys are doing the same thing up here.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the idea. You know, when I came up here, my ambition wasn't to be a sheep farmer. My ambition was to come up here and put a brewery on this property. But again, like I said, in farm life, things take a little longer than you expect. And if you, I have to be a little bit more patient. It takes a little bit longer to sort of get things off the ground. Not to mention money, but it certainly takes a little bit more effort than you think, than you would imagine.
So let's go like item by item. So I know you're growing hops. Mm-hmm. One day your goal is to have a little brewery on your property.
Yes.
With a tasting room.
Yes.
Now tell us what you're up against to do that in the real world.
Money. Well, I had to purchase the farm first, which of course, that took any of his capital that I had in order to make a brewery. So it's taking a little while to sort of get in the position to actually put the building up.
You mentioned some of the infrastructure needs.
Yeah, because of where we're located, we're not on town sewer, so I'd have to put in the septic, which anybody out there that's done this stuff knows it's a huge, huge cost up front.
So it's the wastewater.
Yes, where your wastewater goes, and your plumbing, and the building itself is not that intricate. It's just that it's the septic. It's really, that's the big ticket item. And it's a small town. We're not in a city. So towns function a little bit differently. You can't just go to the city council and say, I want to do this. Or you have to go to the town and they have to have a hearing of your peers. And it's not always as easy as you think. So we're sort of taking it slowly and making sure all our I's are dotted and T's are crossed before we take that next step.
But in the meantime, you've been growing hops.
I've been growing hops. You know, my ambition was to come up here and start growing hops, and I did. And I've had some pretty good success. I've also had some pretty devastating failure because of downy mildew. Downy mildew is what killed off the hops in this region back in the early 1900s. Although they're manageable these days, I sort of tried to take it the more holistic organic approach, and it doesn't always work. So I had a little bit of issues last year with the crop. So it's not as always easy.
I was in your backyard. What do you have, about a half acre of
just
hops?
Yeah, it's just under a half acre, and it's set up to be that more than an acre if I want to. But I sort of wanted to make sure that I can dial it in every year. Expanding is easy. Getting it right is the hard part.
So you feel like one day you're going to have a brewery on this property and you'll be using your own hops and your own beer.
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal. I didn't want to come up here and say, hey, I'm going to become a hop farmer, because that's just not realistic. But growing hops that you can then use in your own product is where I was going. And, there are also, there's a malting house here in New England called Valley Malt. They're sort of cutting edge. They're one of the I think they're the only malt house up in this area, and they've been servicing the local breweries. But I think that they could use a little bit more capacity to be able to service more people. It's in other words, I don't think that they can make enough for the demand that they have here. But so that's sort of on the agenda in the future as well, is to maybe grow a little bit of grain here, so that one of these days you can have a beer that's completely made on premise.
Yeah.
I see that a lot on my end too. In restaurant, you see that quite a bit now with who we're using for wheat, for rye, for oats. Mm-hmm. And not in terms of brewing, but in terms of bread baking at the restaurant, which also is the same idea where they're trying to compete with, the industry. Their prices are much higher, and we gladly support them because we feel we're getting the product that's worth the money. But they're in the same position to not be able to outgrow their businesses as well.
Yeah.
Because they could be supplying both restaurants and brewers with their rye and their red wheat and their malted, the wheat to sell to the malt houses.
Right.
There's a lot of that obviously going across America right now, and I feel it's beyond a trend. I don't think it's going to reverse. But it is tricky to watch how to grow these businesses in the way that all of this demand from the consumer now is, where is it coming from, who's doing it, and locally made beer projects have been proven to sell fantastic on the market. So anytime you see a local brewery, it doesn't matter if it's in New York or in Massachusetts, with a cult following, and they have a project with a local grain or local whatever that's in the beer, that beer takes off without much advertisement.
No, and we'll talk more about that later in the show, but I'm going to get more introduction to you, Patrick. So what we're drinking in the glass is kind of what brought us, you guys, together today. Mm. So, Mark, tell us about the cider we're drinking.
Well, we're drinking barrel-fermented cider from... Yeah, you can pour me, buddy. We're drinking barrel-fermented cider from... The apples come from... My farm is no longer an apple orchard right now. All my apple trees have been removed, and we're going to start clean at some point. But cheers, guys. And... So I get my apples. I've been getting my apples from various apple orchards. Let me just go back a bit. When I came to New England, I didn't care less about cider. And I'll just be honest with you. It never really did much for me. I wasn't ever really blown away by it. But when I moved up to New England, I'm in the middle of apple nirvana. So like I started having ciders and going to all these apple orchards, and then I decided, hey, well, maybe I should try to do it myself. And I crushed some of the apples that from the two remaining trees that were on my land. And I had great success with my farmhouse strain and fermenting at my farmhouse beer strain, fermenting apples. And I had such good success, and I was really so blown away by it that I've just been absolutely bitten by the cider bug. So not only I've been making cider alongside hand in hand with brewing these days, but these apples come from Applecrest.
I love the story.
I traded. Farmers are all about bartering, and I bartered with Applecrest one of my rams for 30 bushels of apples.
Sounds like a sheep.
Yes. Well, you know, Applecrest is the exclusive, the only restaurant that gets my lamb raised here.
So tell us. So you're at Applecrest. Let's tell us more about Applecrest. So this is this historical apple orchard up in New Hampshire.
It is. Yep. It's been over 100 years. Fourth generation farm. Absolutely gorgeous land. We raise over 80 items of produce for the restaurant. We grow tons and tons of apples, all different varieties. The list goes on. Looking at possibly getting some heirloom apples on the farm. Right now, we're actually bringing in beautiful heirloom apples from Poverty Lane Orchards, which comes from Cider Hill. I'm sorry, not Cider Hill, Farnham Hill.
Farnham Hill, yeah.
So if you're familiar with Farnham Hill ciders and how absolutely flawless their ciders are, we're using some of those same apples on the farm for our vinegars. And we have something in a glass I'm pouring now that's from some of those apples mixed with
our apples. You made this cider?
This cider that we just poured now, yep. We just had Mark's awesome cider that we bartered the lamb for. It was good old-fashioned New England bartering.
Yeah.
So we got a lamb and gave you some really, really nice early Max, Jersey Max, Grovstein, and I believe the other apple we had was Ida Red.
That's a super fresh cider, Mark.
I mean, yeah. How did you make that cider?
Well, what I like to do, you know, everybody has a different sort of way of looking at making cider. I mean, and I'm a total novice, so if people can knock me all they want, I don't care because I don't really know much. But I know my palate, and what I like to do is drink ciders ultra fresh. I ferment them. I crush the apples here, and as soon as I'm done crushing them, I pitch the yeast. I don't wait at all, and as soon as it's done fermenting, I crash it, and I keg it. And I think you have just dynamite results with drinking ciders that fresh. Yeah.
And I love that we just poured this right after his. So yours had a nice cheese to it. That was the barrel-aged one?
Yes.
And I mean cheese.
Barrel-fermented.
Barrel-fermented,
yes.
Rather. Yes.
I ferment it in the barrel, and then I take it out in the barrel, and I crash it right to keg.
And it had a beautiful acidity from the early apples that you can really get when they're
still
green.
That's what would, you know, convert a lot of people to really good cider, what you made. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was barrel fermented. It had a really unique aroma to it, very, very meaty, and it drank like a dream. It was crisp. It was really grassy, and it's great that I can have a connection from knowing these apples and where they came from. And the early apples off the ground, and when I grab it, I'm walking around the orchard, they're just insanely complex and tart and not for everybody. Yeah. But I think what you just poured was such palatable deliciousness.
Thank you.
Moving forward into this point.
This is very good.
Did
you make this?
I did. This is a very lightly carbonated because of the apples that are in it. Now, I like that Mark went through what he does with his, because I actually do a different end of the spectrum, and it's fun to taste two side by side. So I press my juice, and I let it hang out for at least a couple days. And what that does is such a naturally, because everything we do is unpasteurized and straight raw from at the farm. So when we pressed this particular blend, this was a mixture of the heirloom apples that we're getting from Poverty Lane. And this is a mixture between our late harvest. We just tried the early harvest apples, mm-hmm. and now we're on to the late harvest apples.
It tastes a little funkier.
Well, it's funkier developed because flavor, I liked. Yeah. I think that's what I get from when I let my cider hang out. I actually wait till it starts to ferment, which this is also you. I wait till it starts to ferment just a touch. But I do this in a very clean, sterilized environment, let it start to naturally take on. Then I introduce some yeast to it, making sure that what I'm pitching into is about 68 degrees, because I like to use a pretty loud yeast. I have a wild yeast strain that I've been trying to keep my own from, that I actually captured from one of the batches I did wild. Just so happened it worked out for me that it was a good strain, get some good esters to it, and that's what's in this glass. What I do after it ferments is I move it on to secondary, and I taste it. And I say, all right, where does this need to go? Is this good to go? Sometimes you get those ones you hit, like his, you drink, you're like, psh, perfect, bottle it. Sometimes with the later apples with my wild yeast, I get some different stuff that I'm not really into. Maybe it's because I'm a chef and I'm always trying to manipulate recipes. But I think it's what this has in it is another 3 weeks of apples steeped. So I bring the apples home. These are all the heirloom varieties that I think the cider is missing. And I steep it. It's a good trick for the home brewer to really put some complexities in their cider that don't exist, because unlike beer, when the cider is fully fermented, you can fix it. You can really manipulate it. You can change it completely. You can, you know, beer is kind of a little differently. And when I'm a home brewer as well, that, you know, when you screw it up, you screw it up. So it's great when you have a cider that, you know, it's got some good talent to it. You look and you go, oh, it's pretty delicious, but it's just a little, and fill in the blank. It could be, you know, light body, funky. It could need acidity. It could be too acidic. So this, for me, I thought needed a little bit of body and finish. That's my favorite part about this, is finish. If you let this warm up for just 1 second, and it's got a nice little hay straw color to it, there's no added sugars to it, it's completely unpasteurized, and it's completely wild yeast. This sat on apples called Wixen, Colville, Baldwin, in Northern Spy. And that gives this that really long, sugary, candy-like finish, which I think rides the cider really well.
Oh, that's great, man. We're off to a good start. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com. Oh, you can do this too.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, it's a special New England show. It's a winter just about 2016. We're up in Merrimack, Massachusetts. We've got Patrick Soucy from Applecrest Farm Bistro and Mark Zappizzotti, the malt shed. We're on his farm drinking ciders. All right. So this is tell us more about your cider, Patrick.
Well, this particular blend, again, it just needed a touch more acidity, so I kind of used a quick little tip that I have for the home fermenters if they don't have time and if they're a schmuck like I am and like to cut corners. You can add your apple of choice, chopped up in a sterilized container. When you pull your cider over to secondary fermentation off of the yeast, you can really add some body to it by adding certain apples that will steep into it. Mark had a great point, and I'd like Mark to kind of ask me some questions because
we're sitting next to his wood stove in his kitchen.
I just had to put a log on the farm.
We're about to put some chestnuts on the open fire. Too.
Absolutely.
So, Mark, your question was really, really valid.
Yeah, I was curious on whether when you add, even if you have a finished cider, if you're adding apples later, does it re-ferment?
It depends on how clean it was when you racked it. But for me, yes, it does start to add a second kind of bubble to it. Mm-hmm. I just make sure that I have very limited, if not any, headspace in my fermenter. And once I think after 2 or 3 days when it starts to, develop a little bit of those aromas from soaking on these, we're talking real high tannin apples, which you can get some tannins on this as well, like Northern Spy and the Spitzenberg and the Wixen. After a couple of days, if I get what I want out of it, what I do is I go old school New England on it. I wait until it's a night and I watch the weather because it's perfect. Sometimes I see, okay, what's the absolute low on the weather today? And it says low of 36. I say, all right, perfect. I shove that sucker out there in the secondary. I let it crash, and I pretty much, because I don't have any glycol, I'm just a home fermenting guy, I let it crash outside overnight, that 36 degrees, and in the morning you'll already see a second block slowly releasing from the middle. So then I bring it back inside the house, and I wrap it up in some foil. It stays really, really cold. I just want two around it. And I put it right in my basement floor, and that's what we're drinking here. So I kind of cold crash a little bit, which also, once I rack off for the third time, the bottle or to keg, there's very limited yeast.
From when you first started making this until now, how long has it been?
Well, this was pressed in October. These are October apples.
Yeah, so for just a couple of months, it has a lot of depth of flavor. It
does, yep.
Yeah.
And again, I'd probably let this sit for, a week on the Colvilles, Baldwin's, Spitzenbergs, Northern Spies.
So Applecrest, so it's one of the historical kind of orchards that's in New Hampshire. I know they had an apple train. People would go from Boston up there. I was reading about a little bit.
Far before our time.
And they just invested in this restaurant that you're chef at, Farm Bistro.
Yep.
I know there's a lot of backstory about you as a chef. You won Star Chef, Rising Star Chef. You were a chef in Newburyport. Quick overview of what you're doing there as a chef. Working on this historical farm?
Probably the best question a chef could ask, answer rather, is, I got lucky. I'm blessed. I got to learn about the farms in the area. Working as a chef, I used a lot of farms, and I still do use quite a bit of farms other than ourselves. We've been working together for over 10 years. It made sense. They opened this project and they contacted me and said...
So you're using a lot of local ingredients. A lot of ingredients from your farm as well.
Yes.
And your food.
A lot of ingredients from our farm, even right now into the middle of December. We decided, hey, let's start thinking about this in July. So in June and July, we're already thinking about the off months, and now we're reaping the benefits of that. We're in the middle of December now. We're going to hit January soon. We're going into 2016. We still have over 600 pounds of tomatoes processed. We still have... over 100 pounds of sauerkraut and fermented vegetables going. And we have a lot of cool stuff that we're going to be featuring on a lot of charcuterie. We have pork legs hanging for a country ham. We're smoking some country ham. We're doing some New England-style prosciutto, we like to call it. We're curing pig cheeks and doing copa. Lots and lots of whole animal butchery going on at the restaurant. So we've been preparing for the winter as you would in the old days of New England. We try to pay a lot of homage to that, which comes with a lot of work. So
like using Crocs, doing
absolutely Crocs everywhere, meat hanging everywhere at the proper.
And what are some community. Of the dishes that are on your menu this time of year?
Well, this time of year, we just finished up using a lot of corn, which was fun to be able to sell corn into the winter because we'd shock it and preserve it. We'd cryovac it, we'd can it, jar it, pickle it. So we've been using a lot of that stuff later on. Now that that's gone, we've been a lot of winter squashes, Boston marrow squash, a lot of heirloom pumpkins. We preserved a lot of meat, like I said before. We're breaking into our own country hams now, which have been aging for about 7-8 months from pigs that we butchered. And we raised our own goat on the farm that we've been dry aging for over a month and a half now. We just started putting that in the menu. So when you come into Applecrest, even in the middle of the winter, you're thinking, well, why should I drive to a huge farm in the middle of the seacoast of New Hampshire to eat? You're actually still getting everything from the farm in the winter because that's how we base our entire restaurant. If we were to survive as New Englanders 200 years ago, we'd like to pay a little bit of homage to that.
What are some of the classic dishes that you would, if you thought of New England 19th century, you might be
right off the bat.
Well,
best part about we're paying homage to the overall thought and process of New Englanders rather than trying to recreate what they did. We focus on making sure that while we do pay homage to some New England ingredients like chowders, and we have fried oysters, and then again, they didn't have fried oysters in the 19th century. They weren't big on that. It was more about salt pork and salt cod and preserving that way. So we do that as well. We do salt hake. We make our own salt pork. And we like to make sure that we always have some fried seafood on the menu, which came way later. So kind of dances around your question. But we like to make sure that we can be the future of New England, which somebody has to do. Somebody has to take the reins and say, okay, chowder, fantastic. Salt pork, awesome. Brown bread, classic. But where can we go from here to kind of, you know, bring New England past the lobster roll?
Yeah, I know. You make lamb sausage.
But then again, we don't stick ourselves in a box to say, hey, you know what, we're not going to get caught up in the, we're not going to, you know, jump and die on our own local sword, because we do everything possible to take care of our own community, as you can see across the country. That's becoming more and more the norm, which is fantastic. But what we try to do is make sure that we don't stay in a box and say, all right, we only use New England product. We make beautiful sausage out of the lamb that comes from Mark's farm. And we use, you know, influences from my travels to Spain, that I've had these sausages and things down there, that it was just a whole different world. So we do actually some New England lamb, but we use cocoa powder, chili peppers that we dried from the farm, cinnamon, brown sugar. So we bring in ingredients from around the world. I mean, right now we're doing our own carrots roasted in coconut oil, and we finished it with smoked lime, and it's just fun to play. So when you come to Applecrest Farm, it's not just New England. It's influenced by all around the world, but the product came from the farm.
So how did you guys meet? So how did you're selling your lamb to his restaurant? And
well, it's actually a pretty interesting story.
You're bartering apples, and now we're tasting your ciders.
When I first moved up here, I'm a beer guy, so I immersed myself in the beer culture in New England. And one of the first people who I, you know, made friends with when I came here was Steve Sanderson from Riverwalk. And Riverwalk was always extraordinarily gracious to me.
That's a brewery in
Newburyport. Yeah, he's originally from Amesbury, and he has a brewery in Newburyport. And he's a salt of the earth guy. Him and I have a lot of similar background. We both are former musicians. We sort of like the same things. We both brew. Him and I go see shows all the time. So we just sort of hit it off. And his head brewer is actually Patrick's cousin. Christian, his name's Christian, and when I first moved up here, Christian came up and helped me set the poles for the hop yard. I barely knew him, and he came over here, and he just spent days working here for nothing. And I always respect someone that comes to a farm and works for the love of the work, because a lot of farm work you can't pay for. A lot of it has to be done with love, and people pick up on what you're doing. is sincere and they help you. Anyway, so Christian and I hit it off as well, and we became good friends. And he was like, you know, you really need to meet my cousin Patrick because you guys would just hit it off. And, you know, I didn't know anything about Patrick. You know, I'm not what you would call a foodie. But, you know, obviously I'm an Italian, so I like to eat. So, you know, he was a chef at Saya in Newburyport, which is probably the only place that I like to eat at the time in Newburyport. You know, him and I just obviously, Christian was right because Patrick and I hit it off right away. He's insanely passionate about everything he does to the point of madness. And I think I've been accused the same with brewing. So him and I just, we go back and forth. And then the whole cider thing just sort of blossomed. And, you know, so it just worked out. It was one of those things where, you know, and he's a whole old Haverhill guy. I wish Christian could have made it. He was going to see Killswitch Engage in Rhode Island. So he couldn't make it.
I got guys that come up to me. He's like, hey, I finally met somebody as absolutely insane as you. His name is Mark Zapp. I'm like, yeah. My wife's like, hey, I never thought I saw so much intensity in one conversation in my life than to see these two talk about cider.
When Mark said we'd come over here and do a show today and he recommended you, I knew there would be something going on.
So yeah.
I'm learning the same as you guys on the air. We're listeners, you're learning the same as me. So let's switch back. So, Mark, I knew you as a home brewer and you aspire to be a brewer. A professional brewer, but what did you pour for us? Because you're still making home brews.
Of course.
And you've got that crazy, when you see the show, the photo is going to be Mark in front of his, what is it, your sculpture?
My brewing is art sculpture. Brewing is art is something that I did with my friend Scott Van Kampen, who owns Makerspace in Staten Island. And he helped me build this brewing sculpture that it looks like a piece of art, but it actually makes beer. So this beer has been brewed on it that we're about to drink. It is my smoke beer, which I like to call Fire Pit Ale, and it's a lot of smoke malt. What I've learned is that you cannot put enough smoke malt in a smoke beer.
That's gorgeous.
I like it very much.
It's creamy.
I like it too. It's not as like thick or like overly smoky like one of the Schlenkerlers.
Right. I mean, like a lot of Rausch beers that are made now, I'm not going to diss Rausch beers because I'm a huge fan of them. But a lot of them tend to be a little bit darker and tend to be a little bit sweeter. I like my beers to be a little drier, so to make it a little bit more
like
comfortable.
This is like a pale ale with some smoke malt.
Not exactly. I mean, you're simplifying a really.
That's why I like it.
Yes, it drinks like that. Yes, you're absolutely right. It's a lot of smoke malt and a lot of Vienna malt, and that's it. And it's fermented with a clean yeast strain. It's funny because this actual beer that we're drinking, I had a yeast issue when I was fermenting it, and I said, oh crap! It was Sunday, and I had no way of getting any yeast really quickly to save this fermentation. And I quickly called Christian up at Riverwalk and said, do you have a pitch of yeast that I can nab from you to finish this beer off? And of course he did. And I was like, it was 8 a.m. in the morning. And I said, well, where are you? He was like, I'm at the brewery. Of course, 8 a.m. on a Sunday, he was there. So I ran over and I got, so this is finished off with a Riverwalk yeast.
It's super dry and absolutely gorgeous. And it has a really nice creamy mouthfeel.
I think that it's the Vienna. Like I've done this beer with Maris Otter. I've done it with Franco Belgian Pils, and I just feel like I use Bryce Cherrywood Smoke, which I think is sort of the kudos to Jay Bullen from 49 State. He turned me on to the Bryce Cherrywood Smoke, but it's Cherrywood Smoke and Vienna malt, and that's it. And I think the Vienna just carries it just a little bit more sweetness.
A liquid smoke.
No,
this is
a Cherrywood Smoke. It's probably, I don't know what the malt is that they use. I'm going to assume it's probably a Pilsner. But they smoke it actually at Bryce and with Cherrywood. People use all different kinds of wood to smoke malt, smoke grain, but I prefer the Cherrywood. And I think it has a unique flavor to it. It's kind of almost like people walk in and I pour this for them and they go, this tastes like liquid bacon. And
I'm like, honestly, yeah. I smoke with a lot of woods. We have our own smoker at the farm. My grill has a built-in smoker. We cold smoke. We hot smoke. We obviously have quite a bit of apple wood and peach wood, which is a little nice. It's bitter if you use too much of it. But this does have a real unique flavor. I'm used to applewood a lot. I do a lot of smoking with applewood because that's what we have
from trimming
our trees for years. And
peachwood is too bitter.
No, peachwood's a gorgeous smoke flavor. You want to kind of tease with it. We tease with it when we smoke. We'll do 80% apple, 20% peach, but we would never just go straight peach because we haven't had good luck with it. Others might disagree. I think the wood is just a touch too on the bitter side. Like mesquite has that classic bitterness that works well for beef. You might not want it on your pork. Depends on the person. But the actual cherry wood smoke on this beer does have a real unique flavor and a little aroma, but the flavor is really unique.
Yes. It's really chewy. It's got like a deep smoke flavor.
Yeah.
And what I like about it is, of course, I brew what I like to drink. I don't brew for any particular audience or market. I brew because it's fall and I want to smoke beer. So I make smoke beer and I have it. And it just so happens that my wife is making this really beautiful salmon with a basil dressing on it. And the smoke beer just brings out this really wonderful quality in the salmon. And so you're like, hey, I'm talking like Patrick now. Like, I'm totally not a foodie.
You know what?
But
you
I get it.
Well, I was actually going to ask you what food you'd pair with this beer, but you didn't. All right, hey, we'll take another short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, it's winter. It's just about 2016, and Happy New Year, everybody. So, Mark, and we're at your farm in Merrimack, Massachusetts. Patrick Soucy from Applecrest Farm Bistro up in Hampton Falls, New Hampshire. It's been a great show. I'm up here for the holidays. We've been tasting some of the ciders and beers that you're making. But we'll talk a little about the challenges of working with local hops and ingredients. So take it away, Mark.
Well, I mean, I've like I was saying to you before, like, I didn't come up here to be a hop farmer, nor did I come up here to be a sheep herder, but it's default what I've become. Now, hops have done well. I've had my challenges with them, with the various issues of trying to be organic, and I'm dealing with them, and it's tough, but doable. Now, on the positive side, I've really made some beautiful, beautiful beers with the hops that I've grown here. And I have, I grow Nugget, Centennial, and Cascade. If anybody's ever interested there, you can contact me and buy them from me directly. But those three, I've learned to master an extraordinary amount of beer styles with those three hops. I try to look at brewing as like, what can I brew with that I have on hand, or that what can I brew with something that I make? Now, of course, I still like a New Zealand hop just like the next brewer. But I find myself, even as a hop grower, not straying far from the three that I'm growing, because I feel like there are such a rainbow of beers that can be made with those three hops.
No, I understand that, but do you think there'll ever be a market for you as a hop grower?
Yes. Yeah, I think that there will. But I think that there are some struggles. I think that, I think people in breweries, I think breweries in general like to talk a big game about being local. But when it comes down to dollars and cents, they watch your pocketbooks a little bit more. And I understand it's a business, but, it cost me more to grow hops than, in the Yakima Valley. So, Centennial, Cascade, and Nugget are fairly generic hops that people can get for a fairly reasonable price. I mean, you could find it for $7 or $8 a pound, and I have to charge $15 in order for it to be even just cost effective for me. So, yes, can it be done? Yes. Is it a challenge? Yes. And you have to get
There interest from breweries in this region for making beers with local hops?
There has been, but there's been a little bit of resistance. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's been a little bit of a challenge for me to sell my hops to professional breweries. Riverwalk has been the one, jewel in my crown that we do a wet harvest beer with them every single year. And I love them for it.
It's phenomenal.
And it's good. It's different every year. Yeah. And, you know, I've talked to Todd Mott about doing a wet harvest beer.
Tributary in Kittery, yeah.
You know, Yoda, the Yoda of the brewing world. He's great, and we talked about doing some stuff in the future, too. But, I mean, you know, to be a viable hop farm, people have to buy all your hops. And if they don't buy all your hops, the product is so labor-intensive and to make that it becomes not cost-effective after a while. So I have stopped short of expanding until, A, I can get it all dialed in without any sort of issues, and, B, that I make sure that my harvest is sold.
So you're going to need one day like an army of students to come harvest hops.
Free help. Yes, free help.
Which is the history of it. Yeah. So you guys, a little snippet. This is over New Hampshire, Massachusetts border, northeast in New England. Mm-hmm. Pick a couple breweries that until you're putting together a little bistro, you know, beer list. What are some breweries that you would put on your list for
local beers? We actually just did that. We do that with our list often, and we actually just threw the first of our own October Feast. It was awesome. We had 10 breweries come to the restaurant, 10 local breweries. We had 10 chefs. It was a huge...
So what are the breweries that you worked with?
Some of our favorites, definitely Earth Eagle Brewings in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They have a great lineup of gruits, and we're good fans of gruits. They also have some other beautiful beers that they make with foragers. That we know very well, mushroom beers, pig head beers. They made a beer out of a smoked bear meat. They're out of their minds, and we love them dearly. Another one would be Stoneface in Newington, New Hampshire. They have such a good following so far. They are just knockout quality, big, I like to call them East Coast style IPAs, big malt. Big hops, but it's still not quite the Imperial. You know, it's just nice. We like Stoneface. We also like to work with another brewery. Throwback Brewery. Those girls do a great job. All female power team.
Those ladies, my wife would be yelling at you by calling them girls.
Those ladies, and you know what? They are some of the best in the business. We really like what they're doing.
Yeah,
they are as local as it can get.
Where are they out of?
They're out of Northampton, New Hampshire. They just bought an old farm.
They just moved their operations.
To an old farm. They put it out in the line. They have this great place, and their chef's a good friend of mine, Carrie. She's a sweetheart. So we have Earth Eagle, Stoneface. We have Throwback, and. I mean, right now we're working with Henniker. Henniker Brewing Company is out of, I believe, if I'm right, Hudson, New Hampshire. Or Hookset. Actually, no, Hookset's White Birch.
White Birch is.
White Birch is also a great brewery. But we're looking at their blueberry Berliner Weiss was incredible this year.
Yeah, we know Bill Herlicka from White Birch.
Yeah, great.
He comes
great.
Down to New York City.
His blueberry Berliner Weiss was absolutely stunning. Gorgeous, gorgeous sour beer. We're working with Henniker. They have a beer called Gentleman Farmer, which is a cross between some local hops and New Zealand hops. Very spicy, gorgeous, like rich flavor to it. That's a limited series we're selling right now at the restaurant for in our retail store as well as our restaurant.
Patrick, why don't you talk about your collaboration with Allagash?
Allagash was a huge collaboration. I'm glad you mentioned that, Mark. That was between the owner of the farm, Todd Wagner, and the owner of Allagash. They've known each other for years. We did a beer with them called Farm to Face. It's available nationwide if you can find it. Huge cult following. Jump on the old interweb.
Allagash, Farm to Face.
Farm to Face. It's a beer that we actually... sold them, I believe, this year was 9,000 pounds of peaches. We did 7,000 pounds of peaches the year before, and they made a batch of a sour
beer with peaches.
With our peaches, and it is only available in the small little, I think it's a 350 bottle, corked, beautiful presentation with the Applecrest logo on the front. That's available nationwide, but it is just a... It's hard to find. Jump online. There are already auctions for it. We have it at Farm Bistro. We have the 2014 and we have the 2013. So
I also have a bottle stashed in my basement at this very moment.
The basement beneath us. I did not know that.
I should say, let me rephrase that, in my cellar.
Yeah, in your cellar.
I know there's a lot of cool stuff going on up here, and thanks for sharing. So, Mark, we're on another beer that you made. What's this one?
This is a beer that's near and dear to my heart. This is a triple. I make it. You don't have it here. This is yours.
Yeah, me. There you go.
This is a triple that I make with only Pilsner malt, and a long, slow mash process. I'm kicking it old school. Like Westmalle is my favorite.
You know,
my favorite
Patrick
example.
Patrick and I only came in to drink your beer.
I can put you guys out, man. I got a lot of beer.
The only
here.
Way you can get Mark Zappizzotti's beers is to come to his farm right now. So.
That's right. And the best part about it is that they're free when you come here. And
right? Yeah, why don't you?
Right now they're free.
It's actually better if the world doesn't find out about Mark Zapp's beer, because if you find out what's going on with the malt shed, you are going to. We're not going to have any more free beer.
Well, no, you guys will always have free beer. Anyway, this is a triple, I sort of do it the process like Westmalle does. They have a direct fire kettle, much like I do, and they take like 3 hours to ramp the temperature up from mashing all the way to mash out, and that long slow process. It goes through every spectrum of the of protein rests and sacrificial rests and all that stuff, and it also because it's direct fired, it caramelizes. All my brewing is art is a direct fired system, so it caramelizes the malt in a very particular way that you can't get with steam jacketed kettles and such.
Yeah.
So anyway. So that's sort of, this is my ode to the Westmalle triple.
Wow, that's interesting. So
it's
is there
great,
any
isn't
is
it,
there
Patrick?
Any candy sugar in this? Or?
There is, but I've in recent years I've dialed it back quite a bit because I like to be able. Yeah, I used to make it in the past and not be able to. It was so hot that you couldn't drink it for 6 months, and I just not a good business model. So I tweaked my recipe a little bit to be a little bit more drinkable. This is a fairly young triple. It's probably only about 3 or 4 weeks old. I took half the batch and I force carbonated it, and half the batch I bottled conditioned.
Well, I think it has a good stickiness to it, which a triple should have, but it's got that candy sugar dryness to it with the big, almost honey-like.
I like the lacing on the glass.
Yeah. Patrick, do you think that you have such a good beer vocabulary? Because
I'm not
as
sure.
A chef. No, I mean, I like the way you describe
I was a saucier when I was a youngin' for a German chef. So my job for a year and a half was to make sure the sauces are correct, and there were 17 sauces on the list, both with a 2-day shelf life. So besides our bechamel, everything had a 2-day shelf life. So
I do think a lot of the best tasters have gone through.
I think maybe that's
training.
What it was.
Yeah.
Maybe it was the 2 years of saucier, which was every day of my life. I was scared to death of my German chef. or maybe it's
cheers.
The fact that it's absolutely delicious, and I've had a little bit of experience with brewing triples. Just I don't know much about. I'm definitely no good.
It does kind of taste like a half triple. I knew it was stronger, and got about a few more minutes left on the show. All right, last couple of questions. So, Mark, going back to your dream here, what's interesting is that you're doing everything for a farm brewery, right? We have a farm, and you're growing hops.
Mm-hmm.
So this little system you have, which is brilliant, and it's going to open fire. How would you translate that into a commercial brewery? Like, would you be designing your own system, or would you buy something?
Oh, in a perfect world, I would love to design my own system. But the reality is I'll probably wind up buying a system when I'm ready that will suit the purpose of this farm. But I love the direct fire only because you don't get these flavor qualities out of a system that's not direct fired. And I mean, you know. Maybe I might be just, you know, maybe I just might be being a little ridiculous because this is only just one beer, but this one particular beer sort of defines the type of brewer that I like to be, because it's very labor intensive, it's very simple, and it's very complex. So it's got all the elements that I really like. It's big, it's bold, and it's simple. And that's sort of the way I am, and the way that I sort of want to brew beer. And also, you know, I mean, what I'm interested, you know, in doing as a brewer is I have no interest in the packaging market. I have no interest of putting my beer on a shelf that's going to get old and nobody will drink. My beer is going to be brewed from my local community in a 10-mile radius. That's all I'm interested in. I'm not interested in package brewing. I'm not interested in, I mean, maybe some bottling on premises. But otherwise, I am brewing for my community, my friends, and for the utmost
but the,
myself.
The direct fire is interesting. I'm just going to throw this out there. Mm-hmm. Our good friends in outside of New Haven, Be United, they're importers of all the beers you heard of from, you know, Schneiderweiss to Schlenkerla. The son Ben opened a brewery a couple years ago called OEC, mm-hmm. and he's basically has a direct fire 19th century German system that has computers and things, so it's modern,
right.
And they even have a cool ship. So I'm saying you're onto something. I feel like whether you're in the Hudson Valley or a new primitive,
yeah.
work with Michael Thor or you're a farm brewer like
right.
Mark, I think embrace the original traditional
yes.
thing.
There's actually a brand new brewery we're actually working with as well. At Applecrest, they are called Neighborhood Brewing. I urge you to check them out. Neighborhood Brewing, it's called Neighborhood Brew Company. They are out of Exeter, New Hampshire, and they have a direct fire, I believe, German system. They hired an older fellow from Germany that has a lot of medals to bring forth nothing but the best German-style beers with no funny business, and we're working with them as
if
well.
If he's German, it's going to be good.
Right. I think my wish for 2016 is that this is what we shall do, is examine all these traditional ways of making beer. And last question from Patrick. So this seems like all this great news. He's put chestnuts in the open fire, brought them out for us. And I think we got some cool stuff going on. So Mark, thanks for having me at
Thank
your
you.
Farm.
Thanks,
I really
thanks for being
this.
Here, Jimmy. You're always welcome, buddy.
And Patrick, I it was great meeting you. I think we have a lot more stories to cover up here in kind of New Hampshire, Massachusetts corner up here.
I think Patrick and I need to come down to New York.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. We do need to come down.
We need to come down to New York and spend a night or two.
I was just in New York. I was in Brooklyn. I had a great time.
Great. Mm. You guys come down. We'll hang out at Jimmy's number 43. Thanks again, Mark and Patrick, for joining me on the Heritage Radio Network.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks to our producer, Justin Kennedy, engineer, Jack Inslee. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.